Hello and welcome to the Das Nostalgia Podcast. I'm your host, Anatoly, and this is episode 2. And today I have a very special guest with me. Sir, please introduce yourself.
Oh, hello there. My name is Brian, and I'm famous on the internet.
All right.
I wish.
Yeah, neither am I, really. Brian and I met on Twitter pals. I don't know what that's called nowadays. And we have bonded over our love of MS-DOS games, the 90s, and electronic music.
Yes, yes.
And so what are we going to talk about today, sir?
Well, today I am thinking we will have ourselves a little chat about MS-DOS games and the 90s, specifically about the music, and also I'm going to speak a little bit about my experience writing music in the mod format, which was a somewhat popular music format around local circles here and there, and worldwide, and it was primarily shared and communicated around modem BBSs.
That sounds excellent. Oh, so yeah. I guess let's start from the beginning. So how did you get into, you know, computers, IBM PC compatibles, and all that stuff?
Okay, so once upon a time, I guess it was about 1984 or thereabouts, my dad brought home a computer. It was a Compaq Desk Pro 8086 machine, an 8 megahertz beast with two floppy drives and a whopping 10 megabyte hard drive and incredible CGA graphics, which could display up to 4 colors on screen at once. And I was about 6 years old at the time, and I was just drawn to this thing like a magnet. I was inseparable from this machine. My dad also brought a whole bunch of floppy disks with really simple games like Space War and Frogger and Load Runner and a whole big compilation of games written in the basic programming language, and as well as Sierra's Police Quest 1, the original CGA, EGA text parser version. Yes. So I love these things. I played them to death. And, you know, no internet back then or anything, so whatever floppies I had, they got very well used.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so back in those days, sound was certainly not a priority for games. Games were really simple, and you're lucky if a game supported the PC speaker, which only played one tone at a time. It sounded really tinny and computery. Beep, beep, beep. It was about as much as it did. And so on a few of these like basic program discs were, I guess you might call them, early demos. They were like demonstrations of text and graphics and sound, and they would play a little song, and they would have like a little bouncing ball with lyrics or something like that. And this totally fascinated me. Because they were in BASIC, you could look at the source code and see how things were done and modify things, and so I played around with it, and I could never make anything musical or anything that looked halfway decent. All I could do is break what somebody else had made, and then ooh and ah at all the cool stuff that I broke. That's about it.
Oh, yes. That sounds very familiar.
Oh, yeah.
So, so beeper sound at that point.
Beeper sound.
Was the only option.
Pretty much. At least for the IBM PC it was. There was the... Was it the Tandy, I think? The Radio Shack Tandy, which had...
Multiple voices.
Four voices, I think. Three or four, mm-hmm. I can't remember. So it could only go beep, 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 but it could make four beeps at once, so you could play chords and do some relatively fancy stuff for the time.
My thing with it was, when the first time I heard Space Quest, the first Space Quest on Tandy, that was like a revelation to what the theme actually sounded like, mm-hmm. as opposed to just the main line. I was just like, oh, so there is more instruments in there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, like, I was very jealous of some of my friends that had, like, Commodore 64s, or I had a friend who had a Commodore 128, and those had the famous SID chip, which had the most beautiful, lovely sound.
Amazing. I listen to this stuff to this day. Like, once in a while, I'll just crank up the C64, which I have never encountered in my life growing up in Russia, because expensive machine. I'm sure if you lived, like, in Moscow, I'm from a provincial town, and if you lived in Moscow, I'm sure You might have encountered one, somebody who actually imported one, but we never really had a C64 knockoff or anything. It was never sold in my country, so I really haven't seen one until, you know, my teenage years.
Well, they were beautiful machines. They're really strange. They the operating system, whatever it was called, it actually accepted basic programming language commands mm-hmm. right at the command prompt.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange mm-hmm. concept that you would be programming right at the command prompt.
It's the same like with the, you know, we had the ZX Spectrum / Sinclair, whatever you want to call it. Those are basically very similar machines, just very underpowered and really, really cheap. So similar concept. And one of my best friends is a Commodore enthusiast. He has like two in his room right now. So there's that stuff. So I, as my life went on, I learned a lot about C64s, but I've never, unfortunately, never encountered one growing up.
Oh, they're cute little machines, and they were, as I recall, I never owned one, but I had friends who owned them. I think they were marketed as, like, discount machines. They were, I think, a third mm-hmm. the price of any other machine. I don't know how much my old 8086 must have cost, but I think it was, at the time, like, at least $2,000 or something. My
dad was an arm and a leg.
Bring it home from work, which was really lucky, but I think that the Commodore 64s were a few hundred bucks at the most.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's why Spectrum / Sinclair, whatever you want to call it, was popular in Europe and Russia especially, because it came in a kit and was like a third of the price of a Commodore. So, you know, and you had to plug everything in yourself. Like, you didn't have a monitor, you had to plug it into your TV. Didn't have a tape reader, you had to plug it into your boombox. So basically just a keyboard, the unit. Really, really cheap.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, we didn't have the Spectrums in North America, as far as I know, or at least I've never seen one or known anyone who had one. But a lot of the UK games journalists like to reminisce about the old ZX Spectrum days, and I can't relate.
It had its own, the 64, the 48 kilobyte version did not have a music chip, but the 128 one had a pretty good music chip, this very specific chip sound. Look it up if you can. It's like AY or YM chip, depends on what version of the machine you get, and very, very specific sound. I still miss it. I mean, it sounds like crap, but
was it like a polyphonic chip? It could play more than one sound at once?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Comparable to the SID?
Not really. Much more limited. But people managed to squeeze out a lot of it. You know, the talented composers like, you know, all the 8-bit composers at the time, like Jonathan Dunn and anybody else. Like, they really squeezed as much as they could out of every, like, 8-bit chip that they did. And, like, if you comparing stuff like the famous ones, like I like the C64, obviously everybody knows the RoboCop loading one,
mm-hmm.
the one from the Ariston washing machine commercial. I kind of can't really pick between which version is my favorite between the two machines, the ZX or the C64. Sort of that sort of stuff. They sound different.
That's cool. And I mean, some of the MS-DOS games, despite the one-tone, terrible beeper sound device that it had on it, some of them had, well, I guess what seemed to me to be fairly decent tunes, like the Sierra games had melodies, and I remember mm-hmm. playing one of your favorite games, Test Drive 3, the demo anyway. Just with a PC speaker, and it sounded fine to me. It had a really catchy...
I hate those tunes because there's only like three of them besides the menu music, and they're so short, and they, like, I, right now you just said it and I just flash back into them right now playing out of the PC speaker. I always used to turn them off because, wow. One of my favorite beeper soundtracks actually is from Lotus, the Ultimate Challenge.
Oh yeah, another racing game.
Yes, and it did that really weird thing where, you know, like every, like, it, I'm not a musical guy, so this is going to be tough for me. So it's really tough for me to describe, but just weird. I've never really heard any other game do that, but it gave that specific sound, like, instead of just, you know, because beeper things could get to you, especially just playing lone notes for, like, you know, persistent amount of time. You know, it's sort of just the same tone going. So it
That's
did,
true.
Like, a nice job just breaking it up, even if it was the same note. It just stopped for, like, fraction of a second, just go on, even if it's the same note, so I did it consistently. Drow just gave a really like weird thing, and it kind of fit with the racing. I don't know what it was about, but every time somebody says a beeper soundtrack, like that's my go-to.
It's nice when a racing game, if you only had one sound to play at a time, it's nice when the racing games at least had music and not trying to simulate the sound of an engine.
Yes.
That's
like,
so annoying. It's like listening to a doorbell for an hour.
That first Formula One game did that. And it just got... I remember being like, shut it off.
Try is all they could do, because yes, very obnoxious.
Yes.
Another game that had a really... catchy, annoyingly catchy soundtrack back then was Lemmings.
Oh, yes.
It had, I don't know if it had a whole bunch of songs or if it was just like one long medley that would like change from one song to another. And it was sort of like sing-songy, fairy-tale-y, like mm-hmm. children's nursery rhymey kind of sounding. Mm-hmm. Super catchy and kind of clever and sounded fantastic on a proper sound card, but even just with the PC beeper, it kind of... It had a thing going.
It did. I always forget about that one for some reason, but yes, it did.
Yeah. That and Westwood's Legend of Carandia mm-hmm. had a really nice, really, really beautiful soundtrack on sound cards, but it even shone through on the PC speaker. So that kind of goes to show that even if you have extremely limited tools, then you can still make something that sounds pleasing if you have enough creativity.
Absolutely.
So beyond music, some people squeezed out some really impressive stuff out of the PC speaker. We were talking about Space Quest before. The first Space Quest that I played was Space Quest 3. Mm-hmm. And I had a similar experience where I went to a Radio Shack and I heard it on a Tandy, and it sounded unbelievably gorgeous mm-hmm. in comparison. One thing that I only learned close to 30 years after playing Space Quest 3 for my first time was that it actually had a bit of speech in the opening sequence, and it was supposed to be on the MS-DOS platform as well, but they like screwed up a driver file or something like that, so it was supposed to play, but it never did.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I watched the intro on YouTube, and mm-hmm. Roger Wilco says, "Where am I?" something like that. That would have blown my mind back in the day, and it sort of blew my mind that I hadn't heard it until now.
Hmm.
A few games, as I recall, coaxed that PC speaker to do some speech. The most fun one, for sure, did you ever play a surgery simulation game called Life and Death?
I most certainly did, because it had those weird screams.
Mm-hmm. It had weird screens, and you have to like poke and prod yes. your patient while you try to diagnose them, or my specialty was to sign my name on their chest with a scalpel.
That's right. It also had a sequel, I believe.
Yes, number two. One of my I fix people's computers as a side job, and one of my customers is an old army doctor. So mm-hmm. I'm super jealous that he has a boxed copy of the second Life and Death, wow. which is a brain surgery game.
Yes,
and it's really funny. You have to ask your patient to say the word Alice, and if they have some kind of brain abnormality, they just go Alice, and otherwise they go.
That's pretty hilarious.
Yes, I like to laugh at people's misfortunes.
Yeah, I actually, speech out of the PC speaker, to me, the game, I mean, probably it came a bit later, but Deja Vu 2.
Oh, yeah, the detective game for yes. Windows, was it?
No,
was it Windows or DOS?
They had versions for, like, it's one of those games that came out on, like, every platform they could. It was an ICOM game, so they squeezed it, like, on everything, Game Boy included.
You're right.
But the second part, the first part, the PC version for MS-DOS of the first one is probably the worst version of that game. But the second one had that pretty awesome sound from PC speaker, and I believe it's been a while, but I believe it actually had two modes you could select. In low quality mode, the sound was like almost the voice, like it had like voice samples once in a while where you like go to the train station and all of a sudden you're like all aboard and just throughout. But if you put it into low quality mode, it was almost, you couldn't recognize what was said, but you could move your mouse around and stuff. But at the high quality mode, it would actually just send the interrupt and you know, the screen would freeze completely, but the PC speaker voice or whatever sound effect they were playing was actually really, really well done. And at least the way I remember it, it's been like, I don't know, over 20 years, so I might be wrong on that account. But and of course, both very early Castle Wolfenstein games
Oh, yes, that's right. I
had
played
the
that
complete
first on the PC
speech,
Speaker.
and
Yeah, it did.
that's right. But the second one is even better. The second one actually has a lot better speech because in the first one, like they say, like was it Heil, Achtung, Kaput, and like some of them you can only recognize what they are if you know what they're saying.
Right.
But in the second one, beyond Castle Wolfenstein, like well, all the guards that ask you for passes actually have very, very, very nice audible voice when they talk. It's also subtitled at the bottom, but you know, like, and those games are really, really old, so it's really impressive for them to squeeze out that.
Absolutely.
And another one for me that was very important with the high quality sort of wave output is actually Another World. Another
Really, I don't remember.
World, and you could also like if I forget now, but you can. It had two quality settings for it as well. So if you had like a low powered machine, you could run it with a slightly lesser sound quality, but all the sound in Another World is done, was done like on any device. It sounded identical. Like it really, if you had like one of those like 3D6s with a loud PC speaker, almost sounded the same as like the Sound Blaster output. Because you know the sound in Another World is not really perfect, even if you use like a Sound Blaster, it's not clean.
Right. Pretty
It
low
had
quality,
that
low bit
sort of
rate.
like really weird quality to it, so it sounded the same on PC speaker. So yeah, that's
That's very impressive.
another one of those games. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I can think of a few more, but those are the ones that are that I remember being very impressed by.
So, I guess what it all comes down to is it was a very limited device, could only play one sound at a time. Usually, if there was either music or sound, you couldn't have both at the same time. If it was music, it was really simplistic, only one tone. You couldn't have any percussion, or if you had percussion, you couldn't have anything else. So, it was just the beginning of things. So moving forward from there, I thought I would introduce the next little chapter with a little personal story from my childhood.
Oh, that sounds great.
In elementary school, I participated in some science fairs. In one year, I did a science fair project about electromagnetism, which did really well in my school, and I got to participate in the Calgary City Science Fair, where all of the winners of my school's science fair always got to go every year. So I was real proud of myself. I actually got to go more than once, but I won something one year, but that was it. So this one year that I went, I think it must have been 1990. You spent It was great. I got to take 3 days off of school, sitting in this big convention center in downtown Calgary, and people would come up to my booth, and I would talk to them about electromagnetism, or one year was about optical illusions, whatever. One year was about circuitry. And so I got to take a break one year, and I walked around to look at everybody else's exhibits, and I totally remember there was some kid, I don't know what his science fair project was about, and he probably didn't even know what his science fair project was about, because he seemed to be spending his whole 3 days sitting there at his computer playing Wing Commander, which I had never seen before, and it absolutely rocked my world. It was the coolest thing I had ever seen on a computer screen. And it was also the coolest thing I ever heard, because he had, I asked him about the music. I didn't even know that a personal computer can make music like this, and he had an ad lib
Oh,
card.
yes.
So the ad lib was an early sound card, relatively expensive and relatively limited, but it could play, I don't know how many sounds at once, maybe 10 or 12 or 16 or so sounds at once. And
I think it's less than 12 because, like, I think Adlib Gold could do 12.
oh, you might be right. You might be right.
So that's like,
However many it was a very rich sound. It had different, not
yes.
just making sounds, but it had instruments that sounded like instruments. It had percussion and strings and horns, and oh, it was super cool. And it wasn't sampled wavetable sounds. It had what was called frequency modulation, which is just like approximated synthesized instruments. But sounded extremely, exceptionally gorgeous, and that moment of my life just kind of changed me forever. That was kind of the point of my life where I decided to be forever in love with electronic music.
Oh, great. That's so awesome. Oh, I love Adlib. Oh my God.
Me too. It sounds wonderful.
It's amazing. I love Adlib. It's my favorite sound device for PC, which was pretty much only used for, music and games, really. Even in combination, like I remember games like, oh, another game that did quality sound out of PC speakers, Alone in the Dark, actually, for sound effects.
Oh, that's
You
right.
could
Did it have
do.
speech too, perhaps? One or two sentences, maybe? I can't remember.
There
It's
was
so
no
long
speech in the original floppy version at all, thank God.
ago. Okay.
Because the one on the CD is pretty horrible. I was very nice to it in the review, but I really can't deal with speech in Alone in the Dark. But it had those footsteps, the creaks, and everything else, and the string sample before the monster arrives. That came out of your PC speaker, and the music could be played. A beautiful soundtrack for the Adlib. Only like four tracks, but enough for that game. Like four tracks for the music and like three classical pieces.
That was a very atmospheric game that kind of benefited from not having too much music because of all the creaks and stuff. Like, it was a game where you sneak around in this scary haunted house, and the quieter it is, the more scared you get.
Very much so, and like it sort of trained you to be afraid of that of the scary music, because even if the monster was outside but in close proximity, it would start playing it, and even if you couldn't see it, and that like sort of early survival horror thing. And listen, quite a lot of times you couldn't see the monster because of camera angles, so
Oh, the camera.
really creep you out. That was one, and I also remember some of my favorite actually Adlib soundtracks. I'm probably jumping a bit ahead, but they come from a French company Cocktail Vision,
Oh, yes.
and not only did they have beautiful Adlib soundtracks, but during a few games had like Goblins 2, you could have basic sound out of the PC speaker with the goblin speech and the footsteps, but the music would actually come from Adlib, because Adlib really couldn't do any sort of digitized effects.
Not at all. That's right. Oh, so it used both the Adlib and the PC speaker simultaneously? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is what I'm
Oh, that's
saying. Yeah.
clever.
So like Alone in the Dark did that, and a few Cocktail Vision games, but it was that sort of thing. Even though some games did, I remember, let me think of what games did use Adlib for sound effects, but they were just
They didn't really, they weren't really sound effects. They would
they were
just kind
just
of
like
play one note of an instrument and.
yeah, like bleeps and bloops, that's what they sounded like. So you were much better off using it for music than for sound effects, because it just sounded kind of weird.
Pretty much. I mean, at the time, there were also MIDI-capable sound cards by Roland, like the MT32. They
Oh,
were
yes.
extremely
That was so
expensive.
expensive that nobody I ever knew.
It was really only for musicians or for really hardcore gamers, and a really hardcore gamer, as common of a thing as that is nowadays, was very rare back then. Like, those are the days where if a game sold like 3,000 copies, it was a smash hit, pretty much.
A lot of sort of high-profile games, like I actually have not heard, because growing up again, I grew up. My experience with the audio hardware is actually really, really limited. Growing up, poor boy in Russia, it was kind of couldn't really afford much, so, and neither could my mother. So, PC speaker, of course, came built in. Then came the Adlib, and literally there was nothing else for me until the mid-90s where I could actually afford a decent Sound Blaster card. So everything between is kind of lost to me. So only now I'm discovering, thank God, for the internet, I'm discovering all this stuff. So like a few years ago stumbled on the MT32 video of Police Quest 2, and that just blew my mind.
It's unbelievable.
I was just
It
like
sounds very lifelike.
really I was just like amazing, amazing. I was like, that synthesized sound like sounds really good, especially considering what's that, like I guess 1988 the MT32 kind of dropped. So
I think so.
for that time, really, really impressive. But I can only imagine, like, that would cost like, I don't know, two black market kidneys or something. It's just
Pretty much. I think they were $600 or $700 or $800. It was an external device that needed its own power supply, and I don't know if it had drivers or something. It was like a finicky thing where if you did the wrong thing, then all the instruments turned to piano or something, and you had to fiddle with it. Had buttons on the front. It was very complex. It was really for enthusiasts and
I could imagine.
musicians.
It looks like a big unit. Plus, it also comes from, the era where everything, every device for a computer cost an arm and leg. I mean, like, in those days, if you wanted, you know, a hard drive that would be, I don't know, 20 megs, or maybe slightly over than that, you could buy the car for the same amount of money. So,
more or less, yeah.
One of the things from that era that I'm sure nobody misses, that most people have forgotten about, but yeah, nothing was really cheap. I mean, even AdLib, which was a really primitive sound card, in, you know, technically, something that later basically Sound Blaster came with, basically, that was also pretty expensive when it originally came out, which was also like sort of around 87, I think.
Yeah, I think there were $100 or thereabouts, which in the 80s it might be twice, like the equivalent of twice as much money nowadays.
Yeah,
so that's a lot of money.
Pretty much. So it's not, you know, it wasn't cheap, and especially for a kid, you know, that wasn't really like had to beg the parents.
Yeah.
So that's that. So, I guess we moved
on. Begging the parents is pretty much what I did.
Yeah, so, yeah, so did I for a very long time, too. So, before we move on, I guess, to like MT32, well, because I want to hold on to that ad lib as much as I can.
Let's.
Favorite soundtracks? Because I got a lot.
Well, I never had an ad lib. I went straight from the PC speaker to the Sound Blaster.
Oh.
So that kind of skips a generation. So you go ahead and talk about. And the Sound Blaster and the ad lib, I don't know if they had the exact same sound chip,
mm-hmm.
or if it was just very similar.
It depends on the version, but it really is. Even some later Sound Blaster cards sounded like AdLib Gold, which is kind of like, I still want to like buy one of those just so I can, because unfortunately still in our day and age nobody really cares about AdLib Gold emulation, and very few games supported it too, like Dustbox. Like I remember going on the forums, I don't know if the situation changed now, but I remember going on the forums and people were asking about it, and they were just basically, nobody cares about AdLib Gold, like it's not worth to invest the time into emulating that. Even like AdLib emulation is really not perfect, but I mean, it's close enough.
It's, I don't know, that's arguable. Me, I don't know if it's because I'm a music snob or what, because there is Sound Blaster emulation in DOSBox,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if it's just my memory being more kind to, than it deserves to be, but I really remember a lot of games sounding quite different
yes.
back then than they do.
Mm-hmm. In DOSBox, yes, they do, especially if you sort of go for those like effects-heavy soundtracks, like I'm going to bring up, because I can't avoid it, Cryo's Dune is probably one of the best-made ad-lib soundtracks. So much so that when the CD version launched like 2 years later, they still kept, I guess it was also a technical decision because they wanted to stream the voices off the CD, but even though they had the music re-recorded available in the CD format with proper synthesizers and stuff, they still stuck with the ad-lib score for that game, even in 1994, which was very, very unusual, and had two versions. It was actually done for ad-lib gold, and please, whoever is listening right now, like pause this podcast if you're at home and go on YouTube and look up Cryo, you know, Dune by Cryo. Stefan Pick is a composer, did this beautiful soundtrack. Look up AdLib Gold version, because you can get that in DOSBox, and it sounds beautiful, really bass heavy, and just you know, AdLib Gold had the stereo going. So
was that a Westwood game?
No, it was not. Dune 2 was the Westwood game, which also has a really good AdLib score.
It does.
The soundtrack was so good, and was you know, came out in 1992, so it was very rare for a game of that time to have the soundtrack actually published separately as an album, which it had. They did like a proper synthesized version, Dune the Spice Opera, that you can also find on YouTube. Sounds great, but sounds absolutely amazing. Like, you know, it should be a better recognized synthesizer classic than it is, but the ad-lib...
It's incredibly rare that they sell the soundtrack. The only one I can think of was Loom by LucasArts.
Oh my god, I don't even... I actually play... That's another... here, actually, perfect example, because I play Loom. My favorite version is the EGA original, and play, you know, with ad-lib sound. Which it had the patch later on to patch the EGA version to, you know, Roland MT32.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like, you could patch the original EGA to support to get the music to work on MT32. And
EGA game patch, you usually don't hear those concepts.
No, like was like an add-on disc, I believe, that you had to mail for. And
wow.
I never heard that version. I mean, I'm sure it's on YouTube, and I'm sure it's beautiful, but I prefer that sound. And I have a major gripe with the Loom CD version, the VGA one. First of all, I don't like the colors. I rarely like LucasArts conversions, actually. Most of my favorite versions are the EGA ones. You just kind of see more detail in those. Like, the how much they squeezed out of those 16 colors limited resolution is pretty amazing, like on Monkey Island and stuff like that, and on Loom especially. But my problem with the Loom CD, which, you know, music-heavy game, which was also really unusual for the time. It's pretty much the gameplay is music-based in a way. And my thing with CD, because that's one of those games that streams CD tracks directly. So out of those limitations, because it just basically streams a track, came few cuts to the gameplay, the music is done during the interactive parts, so like especially in the forge, that really annoys me, because now it's, you can just hear the hammers going and stuff, but before it was, you know, music going. I don't remember, like, an Amber thing, because it had the, you know, it's all Tchaikovsky, beautiful soundtrack and stuff. And they also lost the close-ups on the faces, and some of the text had to be shortened. And it's so unfortunate that you can buy that game on, like, Steam and stuff, and it's a VGA, you know, Scum VM version. I really wish they included the original release just for comparison, because to me, that plays better and sounds better, kind of. I mean, like, even in the CD audio, like, it still sounds synthesizer-y enough. It's not really orchestral score for, you know, classical pieces. So to me, I do prefer, if I can persuade somebody, it's really tough to find the original Loom EGA release that came also with the tape, with the sort of prequel story for you to listen to, the actual audio cassette, things that don't exist cool. anymore. Those, one of those. If you can find that release and maybe even find like something to listen to the audio, one of those audio cassettes on, please do. I love the EGA release of Loom. Play it with Adlib sound. It's not just my nostalgia speaking, I hope. It's just better.
Well, LucasArts had really fantastic musicians. I wish I knew the names of the musicians. I guess I could have done my homework before the podcast. But not only did LucasArts have really phenomenal musicians, but they made their own custom music engine, was called iMuse.
Beautiful.
Something like that. It was, not only was it gorgeous with really interesting sounding instruments and nice compositions, but they did a trick which is so rare to find, and it's so special, where no matter, you go into a room and a song will start to play, and then you'll leave and you'll go into another room, and the song kind of, it doesn't just fade from one song to another, but it kind of plays a few notes that transition one song into another, and you can kind of walk back and forth between a room and it'll be the same tempo and there won't be any break between the songs. It'll just kind of transition melodically from one song to the other.
It's fantastic.
It was like a tapestry of music in the background. It was phenomenally interesting.
It's great. To me, the perfect example of that is basically the first location of Monkey Island 2.
Yes.
Where you just go in and out of different houses and the instruments just add or disappear and stuff, or like certain instruments change the tune and stuff. It's so seamless and perfect. And once again, on Adlib, because I know some people, I kind of get into a fight with a lot of people where people like to play LucasArts or Sierra games on different audio hardware, but me, I stick with Adlib for basically all the LucasArts games. I really like the sounds, and with Sierra games, I basically go for, you know, general MIDI. Those are my preferences. But iMuse with LucasArts games sounds perfect, especially in a game like Monkey Island 2, which uses it, which was the game that debuted it. Basically, you know, the Monkey Island, Secret of the Monkey Island, the first one, had a few tunes for several devices, very few and far between, but I think Monkey Island 2 might have been where iMuse started, and they certainly squeezed a lot out of it. I mean, there's so many locations in that game that sort of music was made for iMuse, where you just walk around, you just browse around, and it constantly changes and sort of intertwines, and it's very beautiful.
It's beautiful, and it really adds to the... It just adds to the experience. Like, a whole orchestral song might be playing when you're walking through, I don't know, a forest or something like that, and then if you get to a dock where there's some just dock workers hanging out, then most of the instruments fade away, and then you hear this one kind of, like, piccolo or a flute or something like that, which is kind of a nautical sort of an instrument. So it just kind of added one more dimension to sort of convince you that that's where you were, that you were in this adventure. It's not just,
amazing.
Not just your avatar.
Like, both of those soundtracks, Michael Land did those, and amazing use. To me, that was an amazing use of ad-lib, because, like, certain things you don't really hear that often done on ad-lib, like, again, I'm going to bring back to, you know, Cocktail Vision game sort of did those really weird scores. It's on YouTube as well. Like, if you're listening, look up soundtracks to, like, Goblins 2 or 3. Those are, like, really interesting. Or a good example, those are done by a really cool French composer, Charles Calais. Who did most of Cocktail Vision games, or even if he didn't write, he was sort of like their ad-lib guy. Because even if he didn't write the tunes themselves, like for Cocktail Vision's Inca, he did the ad-lib, you know, he actually did the hardware work. Like, I believe in Inca, the tunes aren't his. I actually, unfortunately, forget the composer's name, but he's credited with actually doing the technical side of it. And it sounds great, because it has those sort of, you know, the Inca-esque motifs going, and the flute.
Yeah, it had, like, conga drums, or not conga drums, but some sort of characteristic drums of that era as well, as I recall.
Yes, and it does it really well through ad-lib, which you don't think it really could do well, but it's actually a really cool score. So there's that. And, of course, the Westwood games, you know, Legend of Kyrandia, those have amazing ad-lib scores.
Very peaceful, pretty music. Very nice.
Yes, very nice to listen to. Yes.
And the soundtrack is as far as I got with that game. I got so stuck in the first area, some puzzle with a bunch of gems all over the place or something. If the music wasn't so pretty, I would have given up a long time before.
Really annoying, but beautiful to look at. Beautiful,
so beautiful,
beautiful sound. That introduction sequence is also amazing.
The animation of the characters too is so smooth, very professional.
It's great. Plus, I love, like, in the intro, they have this great thing where you didn't often see in games where the grandfather is writing a letter and Malcolm is in background, the focus switches.
Yeah, that's right, the field of view sort of thing. That's really neat.
I was just like, I at that time haven't really seen anything like it. I just thought it was good. Plus, it had this Westwood art style to it, with a lot of sort of gradients and curves and stuff. So
lots of little frills and serifs and stuff. It was very stylized.
It's really, really cool.
Willingly crafted.
Supported in ScumVM. So whoever's listening, go find that, play it. If you haven't, very much recommend. Beautiful game.
Get a walkthrough.
All right. Where were we?
Ad-lib.
Yes. Oh my god, yes, ad-lib. This could be just like in the first podcast, I warned that Igor could do like a whole, like, hour on Sea Legends. I can do like 5 hours on ad-lib. Origin games, Wing Commander and Ultima Underworld, actually both sound very similar.
Well, they're both by the same composer, and he's actually my favorite video game composer, a guy who went by the name of the Fat Man. His name is George Sanger.
Yes.
And both of those games, Wing Commander and Ultima Underworld, those both actually did the similar trick to iMuse, which was the music would change based on what was going on. Like in Ultima Underworld, it would be peaceful or ominous
battles.
Music. You would draw your sword and the music would get a little more dangerous, and then you would be in combat and it would switch immediately to the combat music, and then you would be in low health and it would do the dangerous music, and you would win, it would be the victory music. It was all just without skipping a single beat.
The combat music in Ultima Underworld and Wing Commander actually sounds really similar.
They really do. Well, I think they were within a year or so of each other, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Same composer, same studio, same audio engine. So they do sound really similar. They're a couple of my favorite soundtracks too.
Yeah, they're great. They're great scores. really fun to play. Wing
I want
Commander.
to pitch this guy's book too, by the way, George Sanger. He has an awesome book. It's one of the best books I ever read, called Tasty Morsels of Sonic Goodness. It's a really hilarious book. Even if you're not really into music or video games, he's a really funny, larger than life character who thinks that he's a cowboy.
I am actually hilarious. Maybe not that much into him, but I would also recommend checking out his interviews that he did on Matt Chat. Which are awesome. I'm very much interested in the guy after I saw his interviews on Matchup. And by the way, to everyone, like, I know I don't really pimp out like other people's content that often on my Twitter or whatever, but like, if you're not subscribed to Matchup channel, which is basically all about webcam interviews with famous game developers, been going for quite a while. It goes all over the place, you know, from Al Lowe to John Romero to I don't know, whoever, the Fat Man, and just you get sort of nice insight, or like Sandy Peterson, like nice really outlook on old school and current game industry. So like, if you're not subscribed, go search for Matt Chat. It's like Black Lily something, but just search for Matt Chat on YouTube. Subscribe now, you won't regret it. Great channel, amazing content. Just go like...
Oh, I'm totally going
to
check that
out.
Oh,
yes, absolutely. It's worth just like... And they started out with like 15, 20-minute interviews, but of course, by now, it's like they're just like a whole hour worth pieces and multiple episodes for each person. So very sort of in-depth. And a lot of really what I like about it, because so much time has passed, you know, a lot of people sort of share their personal stories and personal experiences. All those beautiful things you never really hear about old school games industry are all told on the Matt Chat. There is my unpaid commercial. Please subscribe.
Oh, that's cool. The only time I have seen the Fat Man speak was on there's a website, gdcvault.com, from the game developer. I don't know if it's .com, but from the game developer conference. He gives a talk. It must have been 96, 97, something like that, very early days. And he's just talking about the state of game audio, and he had just organized... He called it Project Barbecue. It was this like big Texas barbecue where he got North America's most famous video game composers all together, and they just sat for 2 or 3 days together and talked about the state of game audio and sound cards and what needs to be accomplished in the next little while. So it's very dated, and he starts off his talk with three of the most unfunny jokes I have ever heard, and no one makes a peep, and it's just the funniest, most awkward moment. Oh, so I highly recommend you check out George Sanger's talk on GDC Vault.
All right, enough about ad-lib, because honestly, I will never stop. Like, all the French actually seem to master the ad-lib a lot more than Americans in many ways. Again, Cocktail Vision and Cryo and, you know...
And what's the name of the company that did Flashback and...
That's...
Another World? Out of This World?
Yeah, it's Delphine.
Delphine, that's right. They had short music, but very, very nice music as well.
It is, especially like in Flashback. But I'm more like into sort of lesser-known companies. You know, like Stefan Pick did a lot of early Cryo games, and, you know, Mega Race.
Oh, I love that soundtrack like that's... crazy. If you buy the version on Good Old Games, GOG.com, it includes MP3 version of the soundtrack, and it's kind of like a techno-industrial, futuristic, nihilistic kind of... techno rock. It's very interesting. I love it.
And you know, his Dune soundtrack is more like sort of ambient, kind of sort of weird thing going. Very, very French. And he did a bunch of other games, so a lot of early Cryo games, even if there aren't really good games sometimes, are worth checking out just for the soundtracks alone. And then, of course, everything, pretty much everything by Cocktail Vision with ad-lib support, which most of their games were up until like mid-90s. They really haven't switched to MIDI or anything for a very long time. All of their soundtracks are amazing. It squeezes a lot out of that, but also very unusual. Like Charles Collet did the very unusual scores. Anything else about ad-lib which you didn't have, but maybe maybe discovered as years went by?
Well, I think as far as the frequency modulation, the FM soundtracks go, Adlib and Sound Blaster were pretty much the same. My favorite composers were from Westwood and LucasArts and Sierra. I really love Sierra's soundtracks like crazy. Ken Allen and Mark's, I don't know if you pronounce it Seybert or Seybert.
I think it's Seybert.
Terrific. Oh, yeah, they're really, really talented musicians, and they had a really good sense of establishing like a melodic theme that might recur throughout a game. And they were real masters of making music that was pleasant but not overwhelming, so that your attention could be on the game and not necessarily on the music, even though I'm sure most people didn't do it, but I would just sit there and listen to the music over and over.
Oh my god. Aranna's Place and Quest for Glory.
Beautiful forest, sort of thing. You just
like sit there and just listen and relax. Or like the when Hermit talks to you, I like that sort of like comedic sort of thing. I think that was Mark Siebert, but I'm not too sure about that one.
Sierra actually got some famous people to do soundtracks using the simple frequency modulation music as well. Like they got, for Police Quest 3, they hired Jan Hammer,
yes,
who did the soundtrack for Miami Vice. He did the whole soundtrack for this cop game.
Actually,
excellent.
I love some of Jan Hammer's work. I like synthesizer music, so like to me, it's like right up my alley. It's pretty awesome that they got him, and for a cop game no less, so you know, it's that
just right.
I however play most of as I said before, I play most CR games with the general MIDI sound, so to me that sort of changed it. And a lot of them early soundtracks, as I found out semi recently but just later in life, was done for like the Roland cards and sounds beautiful on it, but I unfortunately never got to hear that, and I'm not sure how many people actually did.
Speaking of actually the Roland card versus the other sound cards, mm-hmm. Interesting thing I learned from George Sanger's book was that there was no easy or direct way to compose one song and then convert it so that it was mm-hmm. playable on all those different sound devices. Mm-hmm. They actually had to like lay out and program the individual songs for every individual sound device. Mm-hmm. So it's like they had to compose the same song 5 or 6 or 8 or 12 times, which is a ridiculous amount of work,
and of course
devices that not many people might have even owned.
Oh yes, and not to mention, you know, especially applies in that era but also earlier times with like 8-bit stuff, where composers were also, you know, programmers for the most part as well, because you had to know how to interact with the hardware directly. So you know, a lot of those old school guys, like I mentioned Jonathan Dunn before, and they actually knew how to program all those chips, so would actually handle that part for different machines as well, which is pretty intense nowadays. Actually, a lot of things change. So one thing I'd like to mention before we were about to get into early Sound Blaster days, I guess, anyway, programming-wise, nowadays, and this is like for all the kids that are listening, if any, nowadays, with all the fancy APIs, you just call the function and it just magically does stuff for you, just for everything. You can do you know, anything you want through those things that are mostly built in or accessible, very accessible and free to you. Back in the day, if you wanted the sound out of a sound device and you wanted to actually program a product that you know, supported multiple sound devices, you would be pretty, you know, out of luck. You basically had to reinvent the wheel every time, unless you used somebody else's library. But back in, especially in the early days of Sound Blaster, or certain other audio devices, you would often have to resort to actually doing the mixing in code yourself and just outputting the wave, you know, pitching the wave output to the sound card, which is pretty insane if you think about it. And
it's insane to think that you'd need to hire someone who is not only a musician but also an engineer.
Exactly. So musician,
a talented, unique person that you need to hire.
That's right.
So are we done talking about FM synthesized music?
So yeah, let's wrap up on the ad lib. I love it. You know, I love ad lib.
I do too.
That's it.
I love it too. It's what turned me on to electronic music, so it has a special place in my heart, even if I never owned it.
Yes.
So, rewinding then to my story about the science fair and hearing Wing Commander for the first time, mm-hmm. Begged my dad like crazy, I need this. This is going to change my life. I'm going to use it every day. I need it real bad. Mm-hmm. So he surprised me one day. He got me a new computer. I think it was a 286 with an original Sound Blaster
nice.
Card, which was basically the same thing as an Adlib, more or less. Some people have told me that the frequency modulation sound music wasn't quite as nice. I didn't really. I'm not familiar enough with the Adlib to know whether there was much of a difference. The big difference between the Adlib and the Sound Blaster was that the Sound Blaster could do what's called pulse code modulation, PCM, which means that it's able to play digital audio samples like speech or an actual recorded sound effect or an instrument. So in addition to music, at the same time as playing music, it could also play speech. So early games like Wing Commander 2, for example, when the Sound Blaster wasn't terribly popular, it was still a luxury item, and it couldn't be guaranteed that people owned a sound card that could play digital audio. They had an expansion that you could buy on additional floppies for another 10 or 15 or $20 or something called a speech pack. And so all it did was, even though you had the full game, you would buy the speech pack, and then the other pilots could speak to you. They would say a little blurb here or there. And there was a fully voiced intro, and it was super, super cool. I always sprung the extra 10 or $15 or whatever for the speech pack.
Ultima 8, I think, had one of those
Yes.
where it had the god awful voices. That's a speech pack that was, well, first of all, it was a game that wasn't worth it in the first place. I'm sorry to say, but it had that speech pack, which I'm sure was cost extra, whatever, $10, and
Yes.
was recorded by, you know, by a bunch of like office workers for in about an hour, probably. That's what it really felt like. Some of the
That's usually what they did.
most of the some of the most god awful voices are in that speech pack, unfortunately. And
And this whole era of computers had god-awful voices, pretty much without exception.
it did, like Sierra employees did theirs always,
Sierra
but
was probably the worst. And their games had more speech than almost
than
anyone else in the games,
anyone
and they had the worst
else.
actors. Well, they had like grown women speaking in like high falsetto so that they could pretend that they were a little girl and stuff like that. It was painful to listen
It
to.
was painful, however, I can get accustomed to this much more than like remember the intro to Ultima Underworld?
Yes, that was pretty good, actually. Even though I think that was Richard Garriott playing his Lord British character amongst a couple
It
of
was.
others. Well, it really wasn't bad, though.
I don't like that one. Avatar.
It's cheesy.
It's that and the king and
Kind of Shakespearean. It's like way overplayed.
the guy with the guy with the guard with like a growly voice
I totally remember.
just
I didn't even know what he was talking about. He had this awful British accent.
yes. It just it.
Cockney kind of accent.
It just so, my lord. It's just like
Hilarious.
yeah. It's like the exercise of hilarity. It's kind of weird how you look a lot. You look back at those games, and most of them just the casting and the acting and just the deliveries are like way off.
I think calling it casting is probably generous.
Yes, I
I think
mean,
they just kind of point to their fingers at you. You're
yeah,
that guy now.
pretty much. I
Go.
mean, I like a lot of them. I like Josh Mandel does you know, his King Graham. Does
Oh,
a
is he King Graham, really?
yes so you know, so like certain Sierra voices I could handle, Lorebo and Dagger of Amon-Ra, like that's a questionable game. Some people hate the voice acting in that game, others
I've
like
only
it.
played the disc version. I don't know the voice acting in that game. Even though I love that game, I really, well, a lot of the time I would buy like a CD-ROM version of a Sierra game, because of course the CD-ROM versions were the only versions that had enough storage for all that speech, and I would usually turn the speech off and just read the text.
Mostly because it's also funnier, right? Like in a lot of things, like I kind of like the CD version of Space Quest 4. People love the announcer, people love everything, but I think a lot of those jokes come off better when you just read them off the screen. I have very similar problem with the Monkey Island remakes, where like
Ugh, yeah.
it just like I like the voice casting actually in a lot in those games. And now if the name escapes me, the guy who does Guybrush Threepwood in all the Monkey Island games,
I don't know.
Dominic D'Amato, I think, maybe it's coming back to me briefly. I might be slightly off, but something around that. Like he knows, like he obviously knows the Monkey Island games enough. Like, and I kind of like how they change certain things. Like in a sword fighting, he would give different readings of lines, so it wasn't the same line cycled over and over sometimes. Like, I'm rubber, you're glue, like they have two or three ways he says that. I like
Oh,
that.
really? That's cool. That takes a lot of planning and thought. That's pretty good.
They did, and considering that that game switched scripts on the fly, where you could hit F11 and it switches back into the VGA
Right.
game, they did a lot of swapping, so I'm sure that was hard to implement because it had to work with the classic script. because they are exact even in animation. So whatever, but like I really like the games much better just reading the text off.
Usually I do too. It depends. One exception to that, and I know that this is a contentious one, is Gabriel Knight. A lot of people think that it's really hammy. It was,
I do,
oh
but I
shoot,
still
what's his
like him.
name?
Tim Curry.
Tim Curry, thank you very much. Tim Curry and Mark Hamill was in that as well. I thought Tim Curry was awesome, a British guy playing a southern gentleman, hardly a gentleman, from New Orleans.
I've seen Tim Curry's southern accent in other stuff. Probably most notably to me, there's this one episode of Tales from the Crypt where he plays a whole family of Hicks, so to speak. He's a fine actor, and he gets a way to like carry that game. Like his southern accent is so ridiculous.
It is
It doesn't
ridiculous. It's like way
sound
overdrawn.
anything like a southern accent, but he plays that game. I like that game with voice acting. Of course, Mark Hamill does a ton of voiceover work.
He's a genius at voice acting. He really is.
I love his Adrian Ritberger in
Oh
Full
yeah.
Throttle, the
Full Throttle.
shareholders,
Really?
sir. Like that you can't
He's so
really
spooky.
tell it it's him either. Like
Not at
he's
all. He's
credited
got such a great range.
right up front, but like
And whenever you say Mark Hamill, everybody just thinks Luke Skywalker, but
I or the
he's done a
Joker.
million other
I think
things.
he's
Or the
sort
Joker.
of like nowadays, especially also as recognized as the Joker. Like the second to his Luke Skywalker is his voice performance as a Joker in the animated series.
For sure.
So yeah. Other examples of bad voice acting. I actually another. I'm gonna bring it back to Cocktail Vision. I hate most of Cocktail Vision CD releases. For the most part, they are awful, 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 and they have the same five or four voice actors that are also pretty awful. And they use them in all of their CD releases for English speaking voices.
Because it's a French company, right?
Yes, and some of those releases are actually decent and tolerable. Like the first Goblins actually has cool music, and nothing else has changed, just the music. And the first Inca game, the voices fit, and they redid the synthesized, score proper, so it sounds more close to what it originally supposed to sound like. So that's cool. But most of Cocktail Vision CD games suck. Like Lost in Time is tolerable, but yeah, some of those horrible, horrible voice actors that they have ruining most of their SD releases to me. Plus, they're not made to be that, so there's like additional animation and stuff. Like Goblins 2 and 3 ruins it. Because have you ever played Goblins?
Very, very briefly. I was never so much into the Cocktail Vision games for whatever reason. Were they owned by Sierra?
They got purchased by Sierra in the early 90s, mostly to acquire their because they were working on the full motion video stuff.
Oh, really? Oh, so they just bought them for the technology?
They mostly bought them for technology. They distributed their games in the US, but they most of their stuff like comes in you can see their video codec at work in the first Phantasmagoria game. That was their compression. So there's that stuff. My thing, actually, since I'm going to tie it into the music, and I'm probably going to get a lot of flack for that, maybe even from you. Don't think so. Mark Siebert, that gentleman responsible for many, many amazing Sierra soundtracks, he does not get props for me for the closing song of Phantasmagoria, which
Closing song. Can't really remember.
Now I actually have it in good quality from his website because it's so corny and over the top. The most inappropriate, it literally plays as she's walking away from the house all covered in blood, and that song closes down and it's just like a ridiculous song that would probably not be out of place in the 80s.
Don't tell me that Mark Siebert is also responsible for Girl in the Tower from King's Quest VI, because that song is so terrible.
He
You know what I'm
might
talking
he
about?
might be. Yes, I do. I think all of the
Awful.
songs that the actual audio songs that he did are available in CD quality on his website. So yeah, but
They can stay there for all I care. Those suck.
so yeah, but other than that, awesome sort of meaty soundtracks for Sierra games.
And that actually, bringing up Phantasmagoria, is an interesting segue because that game, because it uses full motion video, there are also some scenes that have pre-recorded
audio
music, which is in like wave format, and it kind of that game kind of flips back and forth between the frequency modulated music and the pre-recorded music.
Sounds decent.
It does sound decent. There's an obvious like you can obviously tell when it's switching from one to the other, especially if you don't have a fancy sound card, so it sounds nothing like the nice sound card that they recorded the pre-recorded stuff with. One really interesting thing that one company did, it was Access, who made Under a Killing Moon. They used frequency modulated music, but they allowed you, if you had a sound card that could play PCM wave samples, you could have digital drums, and so it had really nice bongos and percussion on top of the frequency modulated music, so that was kind of cool. It made sense the way we were talking about it. We did sort of skip an intermediate generation. So we talked about the frequency modulated music, and we talked about like the totally pre-rendered recorded music, like a WAV file or like an MP3 file. We talked previously about the game Star Control, and that had something very special. That had a format of music called mod music. And so mod music is a format that allows you to have digitally recorded live sampled instruments and to arrange them in such a way that you can replay them at different pitches and frequencies so that it sounded a little bit more like live instruments, a little bit more like an MP3, while still being very low on CPU usage and very small in file size. So like the difference between a MIDI file and a mod file, for example, like I said before, the MIDI file, it's just a teeny tiny little text file that says play this sequence of notes in using instrument number 43, and this one, this is the drums, and use instrument number 2, and then use instrument number 4, and then it was up to the wavetable on the sound card or the frequency modulation pre-programmed instruments just to play those instruments. Whereas the mod file, the mod music format, mod is short for a module, by the way. I'm not sure what that means exactly, why they called it module music. It would have the sounds embedded inside of the file. Like you would have a single note of a piano, for example, and then you could play 6 of those at the same time to do a really complex chord. And you wouldn't need to have 6 different samples. You would just change the pitch of the individual sample. So Star Control had this kind of a music. And Star Control 2, which is one of the best games of all time. Incredibly good writing, unbelievably fantastic, very strange music, extremely strange. I listen to it in my car and people look at me like I'm from Venus.
It's amazing.
Such cool music. They had a big roster of different aliens, and each alien race had its own theme song, which was very appropriate for that kind of an alien. And apparently the story behind the compositions is that the company, it was published by Accolade, but created by a company called Toys for Bob. They had a music competition, and they opened it up to composers that were in the mod music scene. Those composers were known as trackers. They had a competition. They just kind of showed some of the concept art and had people write songs that they thought was appropriate for the concept art. They had 4 winners of the competition who ended up making the whole soundtrack, and one of the best soundtracks of all time. And it was just really a bunch of, I don't think any of them were older than 20 years old, the composers, using nothing more than an ordinary MS-DOS computer and maybe a microphone, maybe just recording things off of a CD or getting samples from wherever. The sound of mod music really, really opened up something inside me, because I had only really heard the frequency modulated instruments before, and this sounded like something you would hear on the radio. So I looked into this a little bit. I talked to some friends, and some of my friends had modems, and they were connecting to local BBSs. I guess this was around 1993 or so. And they showed me something known as the demo scene. And what a demo is, it's basically like a demonstration of graphics and sound, and it's put together into sort of like a music video, where the goal of a fun, good demo is, and it's not an interactive thing, it's just something that you watch. The goal would be to be something beautiful with great music, and also to push the hardware of a computer in ways that it had never been pushed before, to make really cool graphical effects or sonic effects, and just tell a little story or give a little slideshow of effects and stuff like that to the sound of music. very, very popular overseas, especially in countries like Sweden and Finland.
Yeah, all the Nordic region.
All the Nordic region. Nordic. And this kind of music, which was known as demo music, it was very similar to like Jan Hammer, or mm-hmm. the also similar to video game composers like Rob Hubbard. Mm-hmm. Melodic, with a really strong, usually single lead, single lead instrument that would sort of simulate a human voice singing a melody, but it was just a computery synthesizer sound carrying the rest of the song, and that's similar to early video game music, like Super Mario Brothers has a really, really characteristic songs, mm-hmm. and they are so characteristic because they have simple melodies that are in the foreground. So that's a good description of demo music anyway. This totally, absolutely excited me. So I got a modem and I connected to local BBSs and I checked out the scene a little bit and downloaded a whole bunch of this mod music. And to my very happy surprise, not only was the music, you know, very small files between like 50 kilobytes, a big mod song will probably be half a megabyte. Mm-hmm. That would be an enormous one. Yes. And this is in the days of 2400 baud modems, yes. which are like 1 kilobyte a second download. So like a 600 kilobyte file would take 10 minutes to mm-hmm. download. Mm-hmm. So not only was I able to download them, but they were also open source. So you could get the software that you use to write each of these songs. You can open up the file, you can take out all of the samples, you can see how the composer put together all the melodies, you could see what effects they used. It was absolutely incredible. And just like I always enjoyed hacking around with the old BASIC programs as a very young kid, I could do the exact same thing with the music, mm-hmm. change this and change that, replace one sample with another, and just be delighted with how the same song kind of took on a new persona when you change these little things. So I reached out to the community and found that here in Toronto, Canada, where I live, there were dozens and dozens of people in this city alone who were making this kind of music, and they organized themselves into groups and would release music either individually, one song at a time, or sometimes they would write a few songs and make a mini album, or sometimes they would make a compilation of the different composers of a group and put it together into what was known as a music disc. Where we would zip up, you know, 10 or 12 or 15 songs or so, and someone would call long distance to the BBSs in Finland and in America and in England, and would distribute our music around the world and would collect whatever music other people had written and then make those available on the local BBSs here. And it was a very lo-fi kind of a mixtape culture handoff sort of a way to disseminate this, all of this music from all over the world, known by very, very few people relatively, and spread it around to other enthusiasts. So, the guys who made the Star Control soundtrack, especially one, my favorite one, went by the name of Malcolm, mm-hmm. who is a guy named Dan Nicholson from, I think he's from Texas, I can't remember. He started off with a music group, probably the most famous American music group, not that anyone is likely to have heard of them. They were known at the time as the Cosmic Loader Foundation, KLF, who, because there was another more famous musician called KLF, they changed to the Cosmic Free Music Foundation, KFMF. Mm-hmm. And just in the true open source fashion, their definition of free music means not only do you not pay for their music, but it is also open source so that you can borrow all their samples, compose your own music with it, remix their songs, or just see how they compose everything. Mm-hmm. So I joined a few tracker groups myself. I composed a whole bunch of music. This was from about 94 to 97. I think I composed about, 20 songs or thereabouts over the course of the 4 years. And what can I say? I met a lot of people, released a lot of music, listened to a lot of music, collected a whole bunch of samples, mm-hmm. and kept my ears open for other video games that had mod music, which were pretty rare because...
Can I actually touch in on that a little bit? Here's the thing. Well, first, going back to Star Control. Star Control 2 is so amazing and available on good old games. So if you haven't played it, just stop everything now, buy it. Also,
it's also free open source.
Free open source, the Orcan Masters. And that version actually comes with the all the upgrades that the 3DO version received.
You might call them upgrades.
Yeah,
Sometimes they're not.
speech and higher quality music, and the music is also available in remixed versions by various people of the internet, I think. That is, up to personal preference. I actually, again, once again, I like the, I mean, it's actually kind of weird. I sort of like voices for many of the aliens.
They're actually really
They're
good.
really
They're very
good.
wacky, and there's tons of speech. It's so funny.
But the music, that's up to your personal choice. I mean, the mod music on the PC version is a bit, the samples are a bit low quality to the, I guess, the current ear. Back in the day, that was, of course, amazing. And here's where I actually come in with the mod music on PC. Unfortunately, mod music was a lot more popular on Amiga, where it was played natively on the hardware.
Yes.
That's the thing. In the early 90s, where PCs finally caught up with Amiga in terms of performance, and most of the versions were identical, using the same graphics often, without reworking it, even though VGA for PC really allowed for more colors in 64, like on Amiga. Often the graphics were reused because they were smartly dithered and all that stuff. Very often you would lose up on the amazing soundtrack just to be replaced with something a lot crappier, like in game. I mean, in the early days of PCs, where Amiga basically won all accounts.
Oh yeah.
That was even without the question. Some of the PC games were at the time like in EGA and stuff like this, but where our Amiga games were 64 colors in EGA, and had this amazing music and sound, which of
Yeah,
course,
real multimedia PC.
that's right, and very early on too, very fast for the time, to all kinds of weird and interesting games that like I'm again only now discovering that never came to PC. They look gorgeous, but by the time when they went head to head with everything, and the PC started outperforming just on processor alone, what you would often lose out on amazing soundtracks. And again, I'm gonna bring up Lotus, the Ultimate Challenge, also known as Lotus 3 on every platform but PC. That soundtrack on Amiga is amazing, even though I like the PC speaker one, the Adlib one on PC, the one on Amiga, and the game to me that, or Elvira, the Horrorsoft games from the people. I never knew until I. The game, the Adlib music is kind of good, and it's very, very different from the one on Amiga. Just not the same melodies redone, because very often you'd get the same melodies redone in Adlib, and you would see where it would lose out. Like a game like Cannon Fodder, which is an amazing game, which I love a lot. Actually,
Me too.
the only thing that's missing is the Amiga soundtrack, and all those tunes sound kind of tiny in comparison to the mod music that the Amiga version offered. But the Elvira games, the second to last games that Horrorsoft made before they renamed themselves AdventureSoft and made the Simon the Sorcerer games, they made horror games, and they had two Elvira licenses, and they were the second one and the first one were identical on PC and Amiga graphically and everything else, and even worked faster a little bit. Had pretty good Adlib music, but I've never knew until I saw the review of it online on this guy's channel, Pat's Nostalgia. Check it out. He's like myself, never really puts up any new videos, but his review of Elvira shows off the beautiful, beautiful music in that game, which I wish I knew about. I mean, that music is pretty amazing, and I was blown away, and I was just like, can't really can't believe I got sort of gypped on that. With even though I love Adlib, like I'd rather have that score on the thing.
So,
And
Cannon Fodder had a mod soundtrack, you're saying?
on Amiga,
I had no idea.
yes.
I only play the PC version. Does the PC one even have music?
Yes, it has the Adlib score, the same tunes, but they sound, of course, a lot, lesser.
Okay.
PC, it has this thing where it doesn't have the music in game, but it has the in between levels, like with the helicopters flying, it's like dun 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 dun, or when you see
Oh,
the
that's right, the intro.
new recruits,
Right.
dun 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 dun. It only has like a few tunes,
That's right, that's right.
but the ones on the Amiga sound so much better. And I guess because they it wasn't supported natively, there was some kind of difficulty. It's hard to tell now why once PCs became faster, mod music wasn't really popular on PC. One company that used it a lot was, of course, Epic Mega Games,
Yes.
which used it in most of their shareware titles, all the way up to Unreal. The first Unreal game still had mod music, and that's in '98. So,
Well, even Unreal Tournament used its
as
used mod
well, that's
music.
right, and that's like in '99. So,
Yeah.
yeah, I have that game. What was I thinking? So, yeah, really high quality samples on those, but still, same principle. It's kind of weird that on PC it never really spread. What can you think besides Star Control 2 and like Jazz Jackrabbit and all that stuff? Can you think of like n
Epic were, I think Epic Mega Games were pretty much the biggest users of the mod
That's
music.
right. I can't really think of any off the top of my head that had like that weren't like Epic games that had mod
That
music.
weren't Epic Games. Yeah, I don't know. My mind, I can't think of it. One interesting thing to get away from DOS for the tiniest of moments is, I think one of the most popular games of all time, I think, Plants vs. Zombies by PopCap. They have the composer for that game, which has a wonderful soundtrack. The composer is a lady by the name of Laura Shigihara. That game uses mod music, and the wonderful thing about mod music, similar to the old the George Sanger games like Wing Commander and Ultima Underworld, is that you can change it dynamically. So, for example, the level will start off with a quiet version of a song, and then as things get a little bit more intense, they will bring in one more channel, which will have more intense drums, and then they can bring in two more channels, which have more intense drums and more intense other sounds as well. And so it's like dynamically in real time, the music will reflect the intensity of the action on the screen, which is something really, really cool and not done anywhere near often enough.
Really, yeah, that's rare. I mean, they redone the iMuse with the real samples for special edition of Monkey Island 2, and
Yes.
it took them a while to get that right. Like I remember playing that on the original release, and like it wasn't synced quite a lot. It would break originally. I think it's fine now. I just can't be bothered to replay it. But great game. I'm just not very fond of the remakes. But yeah, like I think it took him a while to get iMuse figured with real samples, which like I mean I'm not that technical, so like I am I'm a programmer, but I know nothing about music. So to me, it would think would kind of replace the replace the notes with like the commands with actual samples would actually do it with short samples, but I guess it's not that easy. It took them a while to figure out, and yeah, it's rarely really done nowadays. Plus, the games nowadays really don't have nowadays scores for video games are basically the same as for movies. A lot of times,
Yeah, it's just an MP3, so it's not dynamic. You play it 10 times and it sounds exactly the same regardless of what's going on screen. And there was kind of a that was kind of a sad transition in computer music when it went from being rendered in real time, either through frequency modulation or through PCM. But then the CD-ROM era came along, and they used what was, you talked about it before, what was called Redbook audio. I don't really understand where these names came from, but CD-ROMs had different kinds of data, Redbook and Blackbook. I think Blackbook was just for pure data, and Redbook was for audio, just like you could take a CD-ROM with Redbook audio and play it in the regular CD player. So it would install the game files to your hard drive, and it would read the game files off the hard drive while playing
That's
the
right.
music off the CD. Quake did that. A lot of games did
And
that,
it
more than I can
didn't
name.
in the early days. That's why some of the games sort of fake the sound output by actually recording the audio in CD format, because early on you didn't need to waste your processor cycles, because the audio data would actually be read by CD-ROM itself,
It depends on the game, I guess.
and just piped out.
If it was going to play something, if it was something like one of those American laser games, like Who Shot Johnny Rock or something like that, those
Mad Dog
terrible, terrible
McCree.
games. Yeah, exactly. That's the one I was trying to think of. Where a scene will play out pretty much in the exact same way, in the same order, in the same timing every time, then they could do something like that. But otherwise, CD-ROM, the laser actually physically moving across the disk, it was such slow seek time that it would like pause your game or pause the audio completely for a second or something between changing tracks.
Well, what I mean is games kind of like early Cocktailvision games and the CD version of Loom, which really just uses one continuous, it's on the CD disk, it's just one continuous track where it just it jumps all over the place, hence no music during the interactive moments because you can't play one on top of the other. So it had the pre-recorded things, so that limited the thing. But again, back in those days, you know, sound cards, you know, CD-ROM would be like a literally separate device that played stuff on its own from the Redbook track, you know, so it wouldn't actually get through your sound card. And when CD-ROM is actually connected to the sound cards, just pipe the sound out.
Oh, that's right. And you would like plug your speakers right into the CD
device.
That's right.
You can do that.
That's right.
And also when sound cards actually started, you know, when CD-ROM drives actually started plugging into sound cards, it would also just pipe out the output directly and just use a separate channel. Like, it wouldn't get mixed in. The CD-ROM, even to this day, I think this, you know, this CD-ROMs play stuff on their own. I don't know, things have changed. I haven't really looked into it, but that's why CD-ROM has its own volume control.
Yeah, they would have the volume knob right on the front, and if you wanted it to play through your sound card speakers, you'd have to actually, inside the computer, physically connect it with a cable from the inside of the back of the CD-ROM drive to the sound card.
Right, but back in the early days, that saved you a lot of processing power, where you could just, you know, you can just play the track by addressing, you know, play the track this, and at the time step this, and that's all you needed to do, while all the other stuff on PC and audio was very, very, very much complicated, so...
Yeah, that's right, yeah, because if it played off the CD-ROM, it didn't take any
any CPU at
whatsoever.
All.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that.
That's right. Mm. So pretty much from there, then from there on, it just kind of all went to pre-rendered MP3 wave, that sort of a thing, and that that freed up game composers to compose music either with live instruments or with synthesizers or any combination of the two, mm-hmm. anything that they could record with a microphone or with a sampler, and that completely freed up composers to do anything just like it would be in they would compose for movies or for TV or for a stage production, anything like that. And it was kind of a sad day for video games, I think, because it's rare nowadays that you have a real-time rendered soundtrack.
Oh, yes.
I know that Nintendo likes to do that still, I think, for their Zelda games and for... just for the Zelda game specifically, I think they still choose to use the MIDI samples.
But they're MIDI samples. They're not actually being rendered on the hardware, right?
No, they are. Well, I am not sure. I think it is actually on board. I think it's on board
really?
MIDI wavetable.
Wow.
That was the most recent one, I think, was whatever the one on Wii was. I didn't play it, but I read about this. And a lot of people complained about it, saying that it sounded video gamey. But for me, that's a compliment and not a a blemish.
I miss sound of certain chips. I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, you could use those things. I'm actually going to talk about something I never do. I'm going to talk about consoles. But really, for my good example, I actually hate the Sega. You know, Mega Drive, Genesis, whatever, sound chip, which is actually technically...
Kind of tinny.
Technically not that far from the Adlib one. It's only like a few models away. You know, it's a Yamaha chip. And it sounds kind of the same, only more metallic.
Very metallic and tinny and like trebly. It's very kind of cheese gratery.
But it has like sort of almost the same range as the Adlib one, just not nowhere near as good. And I always hated it. However, Jesper Kidd, the guy who's mostly known for his work on Hitman series, I think, in the modern games, he did this really aggressive soundtrack for the game for Genesis. It came so late, nobody knows about it. And most people say, you will say Adventures of Batman and Robin, and people will think the Super Nintendo version with actual mod soundtrack and like nice animation, but shit game. It's an awesome beat-em-up treasure style for Sega Genesis that has some of the most creative use of the Sega Genesis music hardware. I encourage everybody to look it up, Adventures of Batman and Robin for Genesis. It's really sort of aggressive, industrial, sort of like really very fitting with the metal instruments that metal sound that the Genesis chip produced, but it just used in such aggressive manner. I don't think anything ever like even came close to using that chip so much. Like that was really that game push. I love that game's soundtrack. Like I remember my friend had Genesis, so he brought it all one day. He's like, "You gotta check this out." '96, and he like popped the game in, and I was just blown away by the visuals and like really, really weird kind of soundtrack that I don't think any game in 16-bit era. And never mind, even now, like I don't think any game ever that I've ever encountered in my life ever had that style soundtrack.
There were a few that had kind of the industrial metal sort of a sound. Darn, I can't think of the name.
Really,
like one game for Super Nintendo was Spider-Man and the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
Had incredible soundtrack, and it was some of it was dancey and some of it was industrial. It kind of went all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
That used real sampled instruments as well.
Right. Well, all Super Nintendo games did, right? Because it didn't have any other music hardware besides the sampled one, yeah, because it had the mod thing going for it. So
I guess just some games had better sounds than others.
Mm-hmm. I think they're all, it's all sampled. Like Nintendo games, I usually sound more sort of thing. But even then, you think of like Zelda games, and they sort of had those strings going to that's why technically Super Nintendo was miles ahead of Sega Genesis in just in every aspect, even though I never seen one growing up either. It's really weird with how import worked in my country, but I always hated Sega Genesis chip. But I do encourage once again everybody to look up Adventures of Batman Robin. Just might not the music by itself might not be your cup of tea, and a lot of people actually don't like that soundtrack. It's one of my favorite game soundtracks, gotta be, just for originality alone. Plus I kind of like enjoy that sort of music. Very, very aggressive and all over, like the whole, and music numbers themselves too, they squeezed out a lot of Sega Genesis because they're not short. Like if you play the actual files, like you download the chip music files that have the pieces in their entirety, some of them go over 10 minutes. Which is unusual for the era as well. So a lot of them are like 10, 15, some of them I think even like damn near 20 minutes long.
That's amazing. Usually the songs were like 3 minutes if that.
Yeah, so yeah, they're huge. Just sort of really weird, very unique use of hardware from the game that nobody knows about because it came out when nobody really cared for Genesis. Like, who cared? Like, I was playing Quake at the time. What did I care about the 2D beat-em-up on the console that was dying? But, nevertheless, it's pretty amazing. And it's one of the few times I'm actually going to talk about consoles in the past on this podcast. So, what else? Take it away, sir.
Oh, gosh. Well, we're getting close to the end here. Well, that's about as much as I had to say about video game music. I got a little bit more to say about mod music and how it kind of broke away from video games.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
So mod music does actually have roots with video games, but not directly as being compositions for songs. The first mod music and the demo scene, which I spoke about before in particular, stemmed from the Commodore 64 days when hackers would crack a game, which meant mm-hmm. that they would take out the copy protection, and they were very proud of themselves for having cracked the security in the games. They would make a little introduction with graphics and music and have it load automatically before you could play the game. It might say cracked by the crazy one or mm-hmm. something like that. Then as games got more popular and the copy protection got more sophisticated and the crackers and hackers got a lot more talented at breaking the law and breaking the protection, they got more talented musicians and more talented artists to create these introductions that got more elaborate. The crackers would compete with each other to see who could crack the game first, and also the musicians and the artists would compete with each other to see who could have the most impressive little demonstration before the game started. Eventually, the graphics and sound guys kind of broke away from the video game cracking aspect just because it was a very limited medium for them to show off their work. And so that broke away entirely and turned into the demo scene. And so that started off on the Commodore 64, really, really took off on the Amiga. I never had an Amiga, so I can't speak too much to it. But as you said, because it ran natively on the hardware, it was much more popular because it didn't matter who you were. As long as you had an Amiga, you would hear the songs exactly as they were intended to be played. So came over to the DOS side, software got more and more sophisticated. I personally started off using a piece of software called Scream Tracker 3, mm-hmm. which was made by the Future Crew mm-hmm. in Finland. The Future Crew was probably the most recognizable, the biggest demo scene group. Mm-hmm. Very, very talented programmers. A lot of them went on to the company Remedy
that's
which
right.
made the Max Payne series, amongst many other games. And they published some games with mod music, which makes sense as well.
Death Rally one of them? Oh, no. I don't really
Death Rally
that.
Was one of them, yes. Mm. Yes, it was. A great soundtrack and really impactful, cool instruments. I can't think of their other games right now. The two musicians that I absolutely completely idolized went by the names Purple Motion and Skaven. Purple Motion went on to be a professional musician, and he's also an orchestra conductor, and he records music commercially, professionally. Mm-hmm. Skaven went on to join Remedy, and he became their sound designer and a composer for some games, but now I think he's just like the senior sound designer and producer. Extremely talented guys. They made some really memorable songs. If you look into their sound files, specifically Purple Motion, extremely talented programmer and very creative guy. He had one song which totally blew my mind. It's called Zack Zacka Zack Zack. Sounds really rich and complex, and he just wrote the song as a challenge to himself. It only uses two channels at one time. So even though he uses like various trickery of kind of interlacing drums between chords or using trickery of stereo or all kinds of stuff, using arpeggio instead of chords to make sounds a little bit richer and fuller. Very, very cool kind of bit of music hackery there. So it's a lot of fun to look at the how they put these programs together, how they put these songs together. And by the way, if anyone out there listening ever wants to check out mod music, I would recommend a fantastic free program called Open Mod Plug Tracker. Mm-hmm. I have a video on YouTube. My song is called Technophrenia that I put on YouTube, where I play my song in Open Mod Plug Tracker, Open MPT. I play my song on there, and I have little annotations that show what the different channels mean. Because it was a very kind of programmery sort of a format, the software is lays out the music tracks in hexadecimal, because music is measured in patterns of four for the most part, regular 4/4 time signature music measured in four patterns of four, which equates very well to hexadecimal, which means that instead of counting from 1 to 10, you count from 1 to 16. Mm-hmm. So that's all in hexadecimal. It would have instructions on how to play a sample, and it would say which sample to play and under which circumstances, and then it had another configuration option that allowed you to apply effects like echo and chorus and portamentos, which mean that you can slide the pitch up and down, and there were 100 or so different samples. Scream Tracker 3 only let you do... Sorry, effects, I meant to say, not samples. Scream Tracker 3 let you only do one effect per channel, but I used software later on called Digitracker from Germany, another free program for DOS, which allowed you to do two effects per sample, and that was pretty CPU intensive. These are back in the days when if you found like a 64 kilobit per second MP3, it would probably use about 80% of your CPU just to play it. So using two effects on one of 16 or 32 channels took a really powerful PC just to play this kind of music. So I've kind of covered a lot of the stuff about trackers and groups. However, in Finland, especially, and in Sweden, they had competitions. They would have a big convention of all of the mod and demo people who would come together. They would compose songs, they would create demos, and they would show them to humongous, enormous audiences, often who would bring their own home PC to this thing and connect it into a gigantic LAN party. Thousands and thousands of people who would basically either stay up for 3 days or sleep underneath a desk, pirate software like crazy, share music, share demos, and it was just a big celebration of computer culture. Very, very popular in Finland and in Sweden. The biggest one in Finland, which has been going on for at least 20 years or so now, is called Assembly. Mm-hmm. I think assembly.org is their website. There's a big one in Sweden called DreamHack. And I wish I had gone, but there was a small one held in Montreal in, I think, 95 and 96, maybe 96 and 97. It was called NAID, the North American International Demo Competition, where a few people in one of the groups that I had released music for, they participated, and I don't think... Well, one of them placed. One of them got, I think, the second best song. Hmm. In a competition, which is very impressive considering it was people from the whole continent. Otherwise, I don't know. I guess that's just about it. It's free open source music, and it is freely available. People who sold their music were frowned upon. It was encouraged for people to compose as much of the music themselves as possible, so it was frowned upon if you borrowed somebody else's melody, or the big no-no was if you used a drum loop like you would hear in old techno mm-hmm. music or in drum and bass music. If you had a drum loop that went on for four bars, that was really frowned upon. People would say, sample the individual instruments yourself, make your own drums, don't play a sample that loops over and over. Mm-hmm. But as sampling got more popular in music, in pop music, thanks to dance music and rap music, then people got a little bit less stingy about that sort of a thing. So personally, as I said, I wrote about 20 songs thereabouts. It works out to almost 2 hours of music. I'm really proud of it. I listen to it here and there, even though it's quite simplistic and probably not even very good. The highlights of my own, if you'll call it a career, even though I never have sold music, and I don't think I would, even if I could, just as a, I don't know, open source is sort of a religion for me, so I think that's important. The highlights for me were, number one, I had placed in some competition which was supposed to result in an audio CD being sold, and I had to sign a contract which I faxed back to them, and I don't think the audio CD ever happened because I never heard from them again. Probably the most impactful thing ever, though, for me was when I was asked to attend a rave at, I think it was called Jet Nightclub at the time, downtown Toronto, where one of my colleagues, he was another mod tracker, he went by the very strange name Dysniak. Didn't mean anything. He just liked how like Slavic and Russian kind of language sound, and he made up a word that means absolutely nothing. He remixed a song of mine, and he did a trick where you can, just similar to what I said about Laura Shigehara's soundtrack in Plants vs. Zombies, he would toggle channels on and off, and he would use his mouse to slide various values up and down to kind of do a live remixed version of songs, mm-hmm. and he actually remixed one of my songs, which he played in front of, it must have been about 800 or 900 people or so at this rave, yes. And holy crap, did that absolutely blow my mind. Wow. I begged him and begged him for a copy of the remixed version of my song, which was called Chaos Around the Corner. And he wouldn't, he was ashamed of it, and he said he doesn't want to release any of the music he made from then, even though I love that music of his. He was an exceptionally talented guy, and yeah. So that was about the highlight for me, dancing to one of my own songs and hearing it on enormous speakers. That really blew my mind. That's awesome. It was super cool.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Other than that, I guess that about covers it.
That's pretty awesome. Let's see, what do I have to add? Well, we missed a couple of devices that weren't really popular, like Game Blaster. Who had a Game Blaster? Nobody cares for Game Blaster.
Was that the Disney one?
No, that's Disney Sound
Source. They had the Sound Source.
That's something I'm going to touch upon a lot, because I have a personal connection to that, which I brought up on Twitter numerous times, but it's a funny story, and from an ass-backwards country that I came from. well, Game Blaster is just like Adlib, only worse. Sounds like... That actually sounds like something not Nintendo would make, but the Sega Master System. Sort of like, those are very close and just really electronic sounds that you didn't want in your game, really. Disney Sound Source was this weird peripheral, which is like $20, and you plug it into your LPT, the printer port of all things, those things existed. And it basically just, the game did the mixing on its own and everything, just pipe out the sound, just a sound wave that would just play in that speaker with the knob. And it was so simple, you can make one on yourself, which is what happened.
in where I come from, in sort of you know, post-Soviet places, you could buy a thing called Kovox, which was basically a Disney sound source without the speaker or the knob. Basically just a cable with a little dongle in it. You'd plug it into your LPT port, and you plug the other end into your boombox, press record, and hear the sound output from you know, from the games that supported Kovox. There were a few, and like Electra Body is one of them. Oh, it's called Electra Man in the States, published by Epic Mega Games, and sort of like the Roger Rabbit game. And I also think I might be mistaken on this one, because again I haven't looked at it in about in you know, 20 years, but I think certain Sierra games, I might not be too sure about the technicalities, but I think they allowed music to be played from Disney sound source somehow, so they digitized.
I think the way the Sierra ones worked was that they allowed you to couple the Disney sound source with another sound card, where the, I think the Disney sound source, it was basically just like a device that would play
wave files,
a single wave file.
So you just output it.
That's all it did.
Because you can actually look up, just if you look up for, you know, make your own Kovox online, you just Google it, and you'll just have no problem going to Radio Shack and making one of your own. But basically, I'm pretty sure that I remember, I still have the driver on the Russian version of Sierra games, where you could, you played music out of Kovox. I distinctly remember Leisure Suit Larry 1, and I'm pretty sure I have that copy of the game with that driver. My memory might be failing me, it's been a long time, but I'm pretty sure that there was a Russian driver made that somehow made music playable. I assume it just goes through like a weird synthesis somehow to actually spit out the WAV file for music. Might be wrong, which is why it makes no sense to me, which is why I'm blaming my memory. But I remember music out of Kovox. So who knows, maybe Sierra Games supported sound sources and as an audio. I guess I'd like to talk about soundtracks we haven't mentioned in Outtalks that we'd like to plug. I pretty much mentioned everything that I love so much about the Adlib. And there's one soundtrack, Adlib soundtrack, that most people don't even know exists. And here's the thing. Very sort of culty thing, Tempest 2000.
Oh, the remake of the arcade game, wasn't it?
Yes, but it's very famous on the Jaguar, you know, Lamasoft, you know, the
Jeff Minter,
the ultimate hippie programmer, yes. Made Tempest 2000 with this very famous Jaguar, on Jaguar. It was made as a Jaguar launch title. Tempest 2000 is very techno, you know, like techno soundtrack, and it also had the visualizer built in. So when you didn't want to play Tempest, if you're like uncarded and incapable of it, like I am, you just put on you know, music and put on the visualizer, and could actually, you know, do pretty pictures for you, laser pictures. You know, again, ultimate hippie product, as most of the LlamaSoft things are. So the version of it exists for PC, for Windows and DOS. And
does it have the same soundtrack?
It does have indeed the same soundtrack, and in, you know, CD format. However, in the setup program, you can select Sound Blaster, and that would actually play you know, the tracks that are included. Well, they're redone, not in MIDI, as the general MIDI as you would think, but they actually played through, you know, Sound Blaster and, you know, and or Adlib. So those techno tracks from that late in time actually all exist for Adlib. In that, really, actually, it's easy to find the PC version. Nobody bought it, but most people have not played that game on PC. You know, don't know it exists. And people who know it exists, very few of them actually tried. You know, it has great CD tracks. Nobody actually ever tried setting it to Sound Blaster music. So there's that. Look it up, you know, somehow, if you can. I don't even know. There should be. I don't even know if there are videos on YouTube online with the Adlib track. If not, I should probably just make them. Because, very unusual, very late in time, techno Adlib, you know, soundtrack for a game. Tempest 2000. There it is. Anything from you? We have not brought up the Seventh Guest 11th Hour soundtrack in the talk about gaming soundtracks at all, which I find very surprising.
Gosh. One of the first CD-ROM games ever. And another soundtrack by the wonderful, the fat man, George Sanger. Soundtracks that I absolutely, absolutely love. They had both Red Book pre-recorded audio as well as frequency modulation MIDI soundtracks. And they worked with the general MIDI standard. So if you had a nice sound card like the MT32 or the Roland Sound Canvas or something really expensive like that, then it sounded utterly glorious. It also sounded really glorious on the Gravis Ultrasound, which is a sound card I probably could have talked a lot more about, but basically it was a very, very a much improved sound blaster with superior
mostly
chips and hardware.
A lot of, not even though games supported it, a lot of games supported it, I think demos are the ones that that really took
the biggest advantage. I think they're used in the demo scene because it supported 48 kilohertz audio, whereas the Sound Blaster was only 41 kilohertz, and so it sounded a little bit sharper and clearer.
Its soundtrack is famous, again, so famous that it was released separately on the CD-ROM, right? You can buy the actual audio CD.
Well, you can indeed. Well, actually, what I own and I bought personally from George Sanger, and I even had him autograph it for me, and that is very, very proudly displayed on my bookshelf. He released an album called 7-Eleven, which is not a direct rip of the music from those games, mm-hmm. but it's kind of selections of his favorite songs from those and slightly modified, and so sometimes he really sticks close to the original, and this is a soundtrack that was very kind of spooky and kooky. It's wrong to call it a horror, to call these horror games, mm-hmm. but they are sort of like Lovecraftian haunted house kind of spooky lighthearted kind of games.
Oh, yes.
And the soundtrack was you hate them. They're not good games. So gorgeous. No. So beautiful though.
3D renderings are great. The acting is horrendous. Stories are bad. Puzzles are annoying. That's my gripe.
Possible way, but the graphics are just awesome. Yes. And it has such a wonderful mood and setting, and the house itself is really, it's really beautiful. I love the just walking around the house is all that's good. Yeah, when doing anything in the house sucks.
And the beautiful sound. So it has the visuals and the audio going for it. Everything else, even though it was so revolutionary in its use of really, really compressed, colorless video clips, and the mist-like puzzle aspect of it. The game isn't really worth it, but the soundtrack, well, the visuals really don't hold up either. I mean, they're low res, but the 3D is okay. But what does hold up is very much is, of course, the soundtrack.
Yeah, music is totally brilliant. I've got the soundtrack original MIDI formats, mm-hmm. here and there. I think, you know, all the songs put together, it must be about an hour and a half of music, mm-hmm. or so. And if you just have the MIDI files, it's something like 30 kilobytes. That's just how MIDI is. Sounds really, really great. Really beautiful. Just really creative, funny, lighthearted. It's music with a sense of humor. And he's a kooky guy, and so his compositions really reflect his personality, which is fun. So if you are in the mood for just something silly, it's a really good Halloween game, because you'll play it for a while on one day and never touch it again, probably, because the game yes. really does suck. But it's great to put you in a mood, or if you're in that mood, to to accentuate that mood.
Oh, yes.
So anything by George Sanger, I will very readily, very happily listen to from beginning to end. Oh, and so a cool thing about that CD-ROM game, it came on two CD-ROMs, mm-hmm. even though the game itself was about the size of like 1/10 mm-hmm. CD-ROM. Only the last very little bit of the game is on the second CD-ROM. Mm-hmm. And on the second CD-ROM, it had that Red Book audio, so you could, before I even played the game, I ran up to my bedroom, I stuck the CD into my CD player and just closed my eyes, and for 45 minutes or so, our very high quality pre-rendered versions of the music, as well as a couple of vocal songs with a nice jazz female vocalist.
Nice.
Really, really spooky, and just something that you wouldn't expect, a really nice little bonus. And I'm not even really sure why they put it on the disc. I guess they just had the disc space, because only one of the songs, like a 2-minute or 1-minute song, plays mm-hmm. from that Red Book audio in the game. The rest is all just there kind of as a bonus. So, and I don't think that audio is in the GOG version, unfortunately. I don't even know where you get that other than the original CD-ROM, mm-hmm. which I very proudly own.
Nice.
But, and damn, that CD-ROM was expensive. That is the CD-ROM That and Myst, the Seventh Guest and Myst, yes, are pretty much the ones that launched the so-called multimedia PC era of CD-ROMs. And I hate that term, multimedia. What a stupid word that is, multimedia. Multimedia means that it's... Basically, multimedia means that it has sound and audio, sound and video at the same time. Yes. That's two media right there. So that's multimedia. But for some reason, whenever we... When they release CD-ROMs, they call that multimedia. Mm-hmm. And that was the buzzword of the day.
Oh, yeah.
So... I have very vivid memories of standing in a computer store just watching the intro to Seventh Guest, like, over and over, just astounded by the presentation, the full screen video, and the music, and it was awesome. I just had to own it.
Yes, oh my god, all those things look so amazing then, but that's a topic. FMV games and everything is a topic for another day.
Yes.
So anything else you'd like to add?
I know that there's a million soundtracks that I ought to have brought up and haven't remembered, but nothing I can think of right away. We mentioned Epic Games mm-hmm. before, Epic Mega Games, mm-hmm. as they were called back then. Awesome soundtrack by them is in a shareware title called Epic Pinball.
Yes.
Fantastic. It's probably the, until very recently, probably the best pinball game that there Absolutely. Ever was. But the music, mod music as well. And Epic, as you mentioned, with their Jill of the Jungle games mm-hmm. and a few other similar platformers, they used such good samples. Mm-hmm. They used really characteristic, sharp, like arcade game, cartoony kind of samples that mm-hmm. really like jumped out of your speakers. They were way over the top and like tuned in such a way that even if you had awful speakers, it really kind of filled your room. Mm-hmm. And so those awesome sound they had awesome sound effects for when you're jumping or picking up items, and sound effects that had nothing to do with anything. You'd like pick up a carrot and you'd hear a woman singing or something.
Yeah,
yeah, totally.
It's like,
stupid.
Oh yeah, it's like, yeah, like two guys.
Yeah, oh yeah.
something like that.
Great samples. And the people in the mod music, the mod tracking scene stole those and made very good common use of
I don't
those,
like that game either. Like, I replayed it last year as well because it's, you know, been 20 years since it came out and it's an awful game. Mm-hmm. Music and sound effects, however, still hold up very well.
They do. They're just very well engineered. So even though they're really, really low bitrate, I bet if you took all the sound, how big are the game? Is that game? It's like a megabyte.
It fits on a floppy. All, you know, the first episode. So yeah, shareware. Mm. So yeah, it can't be that big. Those samples actually sound fine. Like they do. Even though
just very well engineered.
Yeah.
And so yeah, even though the whole game, the soundtrack, the game itself, the sound effects, it all fits on a floppy. It still has a good like 20 or 30 minutes of music or something. Mm-hmm. And in today's, you know, if you were to have an MP3 file of one song today, it would probably take like 5 or 6 floppies just to fit one song. So
yeah.
Sign of the times.
Yes.
That's how you know you're old.
Things have changed. Don't I'm not old. I like to pretend, at least maybe only physically, but
good answer.
Thank you to everybody who listened. And Brian, where can you be found on the internet if people want to look you up, maybe you yourself or your music especially?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter if you like a lot of inane blather. I am at DJ Brian Damage. Or if you want to check out my music, go to my website, which is demodulated.com. There's a link there to check out my music, and I share my music always open source, always free in the original mod formats, and as well as in the pre-rendered MP3 format, so that you can listen to them however you like. I also have a thing on SoundCloud, and I don't know, here and there. I've been meaning to set up a blog where I write a little blurb about how I composed each song and what my method was, and
that'll be awesome.
The story behind them and stuff. But I've been meaning to do that for about 20 years. I don't think I'm any closer to it right now.
Yes,
I'll get around to
it. Also, I'm going to give you a plug. You, it's completely unrelated to the topic, but you have a pretty awesome old mixtape archive.
That I do. Well, thank you.
Yes, which the address is.
So that is mixtapes.demodulated.com. I am a collector of old DJ and rave mixtapes, and I am very lazily and slowly converting them to MP3s and hosting them on my blog. So mixtapes.demodulated.com.
Yes, some gold there. If you're into that kind of stuff, that's where you should go. And you also will all of a sudden remember what a lot of tape sounded like, and you won't believe that you ever used to listen to that. But, you know, some of it isn't really good quality. Quality fluctuates. Like, a nice reminder. Like, every time I see a movie that sourced from VHS tape, I also get that feeling where it's like, ooh, It's been a while since I've seen anything. Same thing with like hiss and pops and, you know, demagnetizations and volume drops. But it really adds to, especially since you can't really find anything, a lot of that stuff in, you know, in any other format. It really sort of adds to the feeling of the time period. You know, it's
Yeah, it
all
reminds you that it's like a copy of a copy if a
that's
friend
right.
gives to another
That
friend and
you're listening your Walkman while you walk in, you know, down the street in your parachute pants.
that's right. You got a pocket full of batteries, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so there's that. And I'm again, once again, if you're listening to this, you probably know where to find me. So, but if you don't, follow me on Twitter. That's actually where I'm most active for almost daily discussions of DOS related stuff. You know, send your opinions and your DOS stories to me on Twitter at DOS Nostalgic. Also, everything is available on DOSNostalgia.com and DOS Nostalgic account on YouTube. And also, there's a Facebook group, DOS Nostalgia, and a Steam group. If you know you'd like to join the few people that are actually in that, and of course, leave me comments about this podcast. And you know, if you have a topic that you think is worth discussing, contact me in any of those previously mentioned ways, and leave me your name on the topic. And one day, you also might be here with me via the wonders of the technology that we have today.
It happened to me.
that we can record a podcast that hopefully somebody will listen to and appreciate. I'm sure somebody does. This is very interesting. This is like a lot into. I know almost nothing about the topic. That's the kind of thing I will confess right and openly. I might be a very big MS-DOS enthusiast for many reasons, but certain practical knowledge is lacking for me just because of my background. And this was very educational. Well, thank you very much, sir, for talking to me today.
Thanks a lot, Anatoly. Good to talk to you.
It's would you maybe one day you'd think we can do this again, maybe on some other topic?
I would like that very much.
All right, well, thank you and Brian, and thanks to everybody who listened that far. And you'll have yourself a good night, day, evening, whatever you have you, and see you next time. Bye.
See you next time.